Syria are still there. And I think this should not be allowed. The Arab world should work together to try to address those concerns and not simply try to ingratiate themselves to the Israelis.
Last year, when Egyptian singer and actor Mohammed Ramadan was granted the visa, he posted on Instagram, "Thank you to the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid. May God preserve him for the most beautiful gift of the golden visa. May God bless the rulers and the population." Indian actor Shahrukh Khan, Canada-born fashion Instagrammer Ola Farahad, and Lebanese pop singer Maryam Fares are also among the dozens of international celebrities who received the visa and posted special thanks online. Abu Dhabi introduced the Golden Visa in 2019 as part of its strategy to develop its entertainment industry and attract foreign investment while refreshing its appearance with the presence of A-list celebrities in the UAE.
Well, I think it's a public relations exercise and, to present a good image for the United Arab Emirates, because they do have a lot of problems. There's lots of dissidents that are in prison. And it's perhaps also a way to attract entertainers and other people to the United Arab Emirates and try to expand the entertainment sector.
Meanwhile, handing these celebrities the golden visa on a silver platter has triggered a backlash in a country where its women are still unable to pass down citizenship to their children. In the words of Sophia Kaufenbrenner of International Campaign for Freedom in the UAE, "The UAE is free to attract foreign investment by extending Emirati citizenship laws, but it should end the gross discrimination regarding women and stateless groups." Whereas the slightest criticism might be punished with a prison sentence in the UAE, outstanding figures have begun criticizing citizenship laws. For example, Sheikha Jawahir Al-Ghassimi, the wife of the ruler of Sharjah, tweeted earlier this year, "Naturalization for the children of female citizens, a demand. Jobs for the children of the Emiratis, a demand," alluding to the existing discrimination against Emirati mothers with foreign husbands. Emirati citizenship laws also discriminate against a Bedouin or stateless population who are entirely excluded from obtaining Emirati nationality, no matter how long they have lived in the UAE. Many Bedouin have spent all their lives on Emirati soil, and often have been there since before the creation of the UAE in 1971. According to Laura Van Wass, the coordinator of the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion, ISI, such discrimination runs counter to international human rights law and has a knock-on effect on the child's enjoyment of other basic rights, as well as on the family as a whole.
It's definitely discriminatory and very heavy-handed and authoritarian, where people who express, their opinions or have, some sort of political dissent, UAE is revoking their citizenship and therefore leaving them stateless. And also this is a policy of intimidation to sort of attack the relatives of such people in order to silence dissent. In the short term, this does not really prevent the problems, it only hides them. But in the long term, it's actually going to create dissent, create more anger and resentment for the regime, because they're punishing people by revoking their citizenship. This is a very serious measure and is condemned around the world, because you shouldn't revoke citizenship from people simply for exercising their political rights or for speaking out.
Critics say the UAE Golden Visa is part of the country's PR campaign to portray itself as a modern, open, and tolerant state. In reality, the UAE is one of the most repressive states in the MENA region, with an estimated 200 political prisoners behind bars in the country. Many prisoners' families have been stripped of their citizenship to intimidate them into silence. That can be disastrous for prisoners' relatives. All of a sudden, getting a job, earning a pension, education, and even accessing health care becomes near impossible. The late Ala al-Sadiq, daughter of political prisoner Muhammad al-Sadiq, is a case in point. Ala gained asylum in the UK in 2018 after being driven out of the UAE following a campaign against dissidents between 2011 and 2012. The UAE government stripped Ala and her 9 siblings of their citizenship in March 2016, after her father's citizenship was also revoked.
It's definitely discriminatory and very heavy-handed and authoritarian, where people who express, you know, their opinions or have, you know, some sort of political dissent, the UAE is revoking their citizenship and therefore leaving them stateless. And also this is a policy of intimidation to sort of attack the relatives of such people in order to silence dissent. In the short term, this does not really prevent the problems, it only hides them. But in the long term, it's actually going to create dissent and create more anger and resentment for the regime, because they're punishing people by revoking their citizenship. This is a very serious measure and is condemned around the world, because you shouldn't revoke citizenship from people simply for exercising their political rights or for speaking out.
Recently, the Emirati authorities have promised to shelter 5,000 Afghan refugees in the wake of the recent developments in Afghanistan. A good PR exercise per se. Many observers have taken the promise with a pinch of salt, given the grave reality back in the UAE.
It's very surprising that the UAE would offer to take in 5,000 Afghan refugees, because most of their policies and actions don't support that sort of humanitarian initiative. So I would be surprised if the UAE actually does follow through with it. It's a good move, it's good for public relations, but they have to follow through, and the UAE needs citizens and people to work in its country, because it relies so extensively on expatriates to do much of the work. And I think it's a very positive step, but it's out of character for them when you're revoking citizenship and punishing people and then taking in Afghan refugees. It's a surprise, quite frankly, and I hope they do follow through with it. But I suspect that they may come up with some sort of reasons to block it, because there's got many other people, like the Badoons, that should be given citizenship in the UAE and are not given citizenship.
Like many other things in the UAE, golden visas provide the country with a shiny veneer over dark matters Abu Dhabi likes to conceal. Things are not always as bright as they seem in this Persian Gulf state.
Holy Defense, a mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The Holy Defense era was the climax of manifestation of religious virtues and lofty human values. The honorable generation of this era created a splendid epic that was inspired by the perpetual uprising of Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura in the year 10 AH. No doubt, the most important factor for the eternity of Ashura is the personality of Imam Hussein. In the beginning of his movement, the Imam went to his grandfather's tomb in Medina and said, "O Messenger of God, I am Hussein, son of Fatima, your dear daughter. Now, I have been asked to, contrary to your practice, swear allegiance to a faithless and mean oppressor, which I will never do." The Imam, in his testimony to his brother, Muhammad Hanafiyeh, wrote, "In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, this is the testimony of Hussein, son of Ali. Now I am leaving Medina. My departure is not for seeking comfort, nor is it out of fear. I depart in pursuit of reform in my grandfather's Ummah. Whenever I am, I will encourage people to good works and will prevent them from evil. Principally, leadership is a major factor of victory in all wars. The unique personality of Imam Khomeini played a very important role in the victories of combatants in the eight-year war that Saddam imposed on Iran in the 1980s upon the order of his Western and Eastern masters. Imam Khomeini turned the imposed war into the scene of epic. The Iranian combatants deeply believed that their leader was following Imam Hussein, peace upon him. They knew that he was the flag bearer of freedom and justice. Therefore, they obeyed whatever the Imam would order as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. With full trust in God, Imam Khomeini very soon got the initiative of war in his hand and put the enemies in stalemate. He founded the popular mobilization force known as Basij in Iran. This million-strong force shattered all the dreams of the ill-wishers of Iran and the Islamic Revolution. The Imam said, "War against Iran is the war against Islam, war against the Quran, and war against the Messenger of God. And this is among the greatest sins which the Almighty God will never forgive." Imam Khomeini called defense against aggression and repelling the aggressor as doing one's duty, saying, "We have the mission of fulfilling our duty and not achieving the result." Although the Imam was not physically present in the battlefronts, his influential personality would always be sensed there. In fact, his spiritual presence was the guide for combatants. A foreign reporter once wrote, "As if Ayatollah Khomeini were present here every day, calling the Iranian defendants on jihad." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "It is an obligation to preserve Islam. Either we are killed, or kill we have fulfilled the obligation." Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says on the personality of Imam Khomeini, "Except for the era of the Prophet, the era of Imam Ali's caliphate, and the short period of Imam Mujtaba, we don't remember a Gnostic, wise and divine commander-in-chief in the world. Nowhere in the world, neither today nor in the past, do we know a military force that has been under the command of a spiritual and divine man with the finest humane emotions and yet defending the honor and life of a nation with resolve and firmness. The fervor of valor, the enthusiasm for jihad and steadfastness and the great victories that the combatants achieved in the battle against the enemies were mostly owed to the impacts of Imam Khomeini's spiritual personality in the leadership of the Holy Defense." Dear listeners, this personality was the factor which drew even the teenagers to the battlefronts. journalist said, "I saw a 17-year-old boy in the front with a red Yah Hussein headband. He had a bright and happy face while he was tired. He was slim and slender. His young age drew my attention. He didn't look to be the man of combat, yet his face would say, 'The battlefront doesn't distinguish between young and old. It knows only love.' I asked him why he had left school. He looked at me and answered in surprise, 'The front is a school itself. It is both the school of love and self-sacrifice. It is the school which trains perfect man.' Then he said with a smile, 'I have come to answer positively to my leader's call, the leader who has raised the flag of Imam Hussein, peace upon him.' Years later, his mother showed me his photo and told me that he had been martyred in Karbala 5 operation. Martyr Mehdi Rajabi wrote in his testimony, 'We go to the front to secure the Imam's path, the path that has started from Abraham, and in its red continuity reached the fervent heart of Imam Khomeini by the clean hands of Muhammad, Ali, and Hussein, till it will release the oppressed of the earth from the oppression of the rule of the followers of Cain.'"
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, in his first address to the UNGA, says the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have failed miserably. He referred to two incidents that represented how the U.S. is on a downward spiral. For this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what these two incidents that he was referring to are and how Raisi's mistrust of the U.S. and the U.S. failure of lifting the sanctions will affect the future of the talks.
As the 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. President, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We're working with the P5+1 to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States' hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appear to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
Introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Sayed Mostafa Hoshchesh, who joins us. Also joining us is John White, writer and political analyst from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Sayed Mostafa Hoshchesh, let me first start with you. Generally speaking, I'm leaving this question open to you to explain to us what the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi means when he says the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have failed miserably.
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, the United States has been trying to impose its hegemonic rule and order in the Middle East, in West Asia, throughout the last several decades. Especially in the last two decades, they tried to impose their own order to force several countries into collapse. According to a Pentagon official, a top Pentagon official, when they invaded Afghanistan in 2001, they meant to force seven countries into chaos and collapse, including Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Sudan, and Somalia. And they somehow were successful with regard to six other countries, but not Iran, because when Iran realized the threat of the IRGC Quds Force and its top commander, Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, defused the U.S. plan for imposing its hegemonic rule in this part of the world, they've been looting energy supplies, but they wanted to exercise their greater Middle East plan to force countries into internal strife and, you know, wars, civil wars. so that Israel's protection would be secured. First, second, the U.S. could, do a transition of its, assets as well as forces and equipment to South China Sea and to the lands near China in order to pose risks to the Chinese to slow down their economy. Mm-hmm. Once they failed in the first step, they moved for the same goal through proxy warfare. Their allies, like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, admittedly launched a proxy warfare and a terrorist war on Iranian allies in Syria and Iraq, and they meant to do so against the Lebanese as well, in order to weaken and topple Iranian allies in those countries. And again, when they were using Al-Qaeda as well as ISIL, according, we have so many confessions made by former and present U.S. officials, including Joe Biden himself when he was vice president, as well as Martin Dempsey, who was the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, also Michael Flynn, as well as many others. They have all made this confession that U.S. allies caused this war of terrorism in the region, and the U.S. was in the know, they knew it, and they took no action in order to let them wear off the Iranian allies' power, and they were defused because of Qasem Soleimani and Iran, who stood against them and defused the threat.
Okay, well, let me ask you, John White. I mean, there's some examples that say Mustafa Khrushchev made there, but there's two that the Iranian president of MRAC talked about, and this was at the UN General Assembly, his first address. One of them he said was the January 6th, happened on January 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, Americans, and two was the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August from the capital to Kabul. Mm-hmm. And he said that this is what the two incidents that stand out that show that the U.S. is down on a path of decline. Do you agree with him? Are these two significant incidents that point to that?
I agree with him in every particular. In its importance, President Raisi's speech today at the UN General Assembly belongs in the same category as speeches made to the UN General Assembly by the likes of Che Guevara, Yasser Arafat, Hugo Chavez, and President Vladimir Putin of Russia, because it is a speech in which he spoke pristine truth to power. And the difference between President Raisi's speech today and those other speeches is that he was speaking truth to a declining power, and he articulated that in scintillating fashion. And those two incidents are major signposts on the trajectory of that decline. The Capitol building invasion by thousands and thousands of Trump supporters proves beyond doubt that US society is imploding from within, and the panicked and humiliating retreat from Afghanistan after 20 years, $2.5 trillion spent, proves that the US is no longer to maintain hegemony via hard power means. This is a historic tipping point. The Iranian government understands that, and that was, as I say, articulated in scintillating fashion by President Raisi at the UN General Assembly today.
Well, Sayyid Mustafa Khrushchev, one of the key words that Ibrahim Raisi used was expulsion. And he said the result of seeking hegemony has been blood spilling and instability, and ultimately defeat and escape. So the reference there, we can say, two countries would be in that equation. One would be Iraq and one would be Afghanistan. But why is it important to make that differentiation in his eyes, do you think, that the U.S. was expelled? I mean, at this point, perhaps Iraq would be defined more in that category compared to Afghanistan, do you think?
Well, if the U.S. could do that, they would stay in here and they would guarantee their interest. They would stay in Afghanistan and Iraq. But as my colleague said, after 20 years, look what they've done. They have been killing people, and they call it collateral damage. In the last case scenario that they, by the way, admitted, they killed a family without even getting close to the so-called terrorists they were trying to hunt down. And in a drone operation, these drone operations have been, being conducted all throughout the West Asian region, and they've been killing people, some of them, you know, they admit, but some other, there are many others, thousands of other people have been killed, and they call them collateral damage. After killing so many people, and after sustaining thousands of, you know, casualties in the U.S. Army, and after spending nearly $8 trillion, they have earned nothing, and we all witnessed how they, escaped from Afghanistan. They didn't have enough time even to get their weapons or to save their own comrades in arm in the Afghanistan army. And also, in Iraq, something nearly similar to that would happen if they insist on staying in there. They wanted to prolong the U.S. stay in Iraq, but just the other day, they said that they have come across and, you know, they've come up with some kind of agreement with the Iraqi government to decrease the number of forces in there. They have realized that their stay would eventually result in more damage to the U.S. Army forces as well as equipment. Now, what matters more than their, hegemonic rule in here or their quest for hegemonic ruling over the West Asian region is the rift inside their own society. Saw, and President Raisi said in the Capitol, we all saw how Americans raided the U.S. Congress, the House of the People, it was supposed to be. But this has not been, this has not ended, you know. It's really on the way, and as President Biden has proved to be a weak president in the eyes, at least, of his critics inside, we expect similar developments in future. As many American experts have admitted, the real problem and the demise of the U.S. comes from home. And that reminds me of what the Iranian Supreme Leader said months ago, that the Americans shouldn't worry abroad. They should first worry about a home, because if there is a real threat posed to them, it's by the people, by the American people.
John White, you made an interesting point, at least in my eyes, when you said that this was a very important, obviously, speech that the Iranian president made to the UN General Assembly, his first one, which in itself is important. But the question I have for you is, when Ibrahim Raisi speaks about how the U.S. is on the decline, how the U.S. hegemony is one of the reasons why it's led to its downfall, it goes a little bit out of the normal talk, perhaps, that maybe UN members are accustomed to hearing, especially the Western nations, i.e. the U.S. and maybe European nations. And my question to you is, do you think when Iran takes a stance, in this case, Ibrahim Raisi, and speaks along those lines, that these nations of the General Assembly, of the UN, actually understand, and do they agree with the stance that Iran has? Because Iran has made out to be the aggressor. One of the things that Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson said recently is that it is as if these countries have forgotten that it was Iran that complied with all of its obligations under the nuclear agreement and did not enjoy the benefits due to U.S. lawbreaking measures. So do the member countries understand U.S. position, Iranian position here?
Well, to the extent that they do is the extent to which they will thrive in this new world order that is now being established in front of our eyes, with the rise of China as a global superpower and its global leadership, with its astonishing Belt and Road Initiative, which is an investment-led transformational infrastructure program, which is forging successful partnerships with governments all over the world, which is to be made distinct from the Western developmental model, which does not establish partnership per se, but clients and satellites at the end of bayonets and through coercion, with not partnership in mind, but exploitation in mind. The Iranian president's speech today was filled with wisdom and with defiance, and he knows that Iran is stronger in many ways than America, despite the difference in GDP, despite the difference in the size of the military, despite the huge sanctions that Iran is suffering, because a new alignment is taking place. The tectonic plates of geopolitical power are shifting, just as the Roman Empire had its Emperor Galba after its Emperor Nero, senile geriatric. The U.S. has its own Emperor Galba in the safe shape of President Biden after its own Nero in the shape of President Trump. There are striking parallels between the fall of the Roman Empire and the fall of today's Rome, emanating from Washington. I think more and more countries are waking up to the fact that America is a declining power, that it can't be trusted, that it can't, its word can't be trusted, that it breaks treaties willy-nilly, that it's not an upholder of international law, but a serial violator of international law. The fact that the Biden administration would dare set non-nuclear conditions on the resurrection of the JCPOA, i.e. Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's quote-unquote power projection in the region. So what the Americans are saying under Biden, not Donald Trump, under Biden, is that Iran is not allowed to have allies in the region in which it is located, but the Americans are allowed to have allies in that region in which it is not located, i.e. primarily Israel and Saudi Arabia. Such hypocrisy cannot be allowed to continue to stand. And the irony is, the historical irony is that a neocon project, to project for a new American century, with 9/11 was a pretext for, to dominate the resource-rich regions of the world, primarily the Middle East, has only set in train the decline of the U.S. as a hegemonic power.
Indeed, that PNAC project did not go too well, even though the length of time and its span was pretty long. Let's see here. A lot of talk has been made, a lot of projections are being made, or a lot of conclusions are being made as to the statements made by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, which direction the nuclear talks are going to go. For example, he has said that there's no trust in the U.S. He said that Iran has no trust in U.S. promises, and he said that that he wants all anti-Tehran sanctions to be removed at once. He cited how the agency, IAEA agency, has made 15 reports, and yet it still has distrust in U.S.'s, in Iran's civilian nuclear program. And we also understand that there are going to be talks. Are there going to be talks where the U.S. has to first remove the sanctions, as Ebrahim Raisi has pointed out, or is that something that's going to be as a precondition after talks begin? A little bit of confusion here as to the direction this is going to go.
Oh, no. The nuclear diplomacy in the talks in Vienna is the product of the whole establishment, of the policies that have been developed by the whole establishment, including the Supreme National Security Council, the leader, the government, the parliament, everyone. Iran had raised several demands right from the beginning of the Vienna talks under President Rouhani, that all post-JCPOA sanctions, as well as those mentioned in the JCPOA, should be removed and annulled forever, first. Second, Iran should be given a period of 3 to 6 months to verify, because the last time we did it, under Obama, who was after the nuclear deal, apparently, he defied all his undertakings, and he never removed the sanctions in action, but he just did it over the paper. So Iran doesn't want to be fooled or deceived, so he wants time for verification. Now, still, the same rules apply. Iran has the same, conditions. No matter it's a Raisi government, the conditions are the same. What's different is that they are having some kind of, stronger position and stance. While Rouhani was looking at the JCPOA as his, heritage, some kind of legacy, President Raisi has stressed that the JCPOA would not be a pivotal part of Iran's foreign policy under him. So he is going to continue the talks, but he will be more serious about Iranian conditions, and he wants to see the conditions met first. So I do believe that the talks would continue, definitely, but it would not last long, because they do not mean to play around. Uh-huh. They are serious, and they don't want to revive the JCPOA at any cost, under any kind of condition. They will, wrap it up fast if they see that the conditions are not met by the United States.
Sure.
And they know how much the United States needs the JCPOA, because it is weak, it's moving towards demise, and its power, it's, decreasing, and they their only formula to contain Iran is through the agreements, multiple agreements that they have in mind, and the Iranians are in the know.
Sure, that's an important point that he makes there. John White, I don't know if you agree, but I'd like to get your understanding how badly the U.S. needs Iran when it comes to this nuclear deal. I mean, President Joe Biden in his address said that Washington is willing to return to the pact. At the same time, he said if Tehran first suspends its countermeasures taken in response to U.S. violations and reimposition of sanctions. How badly does the U.S. need Iran to come back to this pact? And do you think that it's going to jeopardize this need for Iran to return by not lifting sanctions the way Iran thinks that it should?
Biden administration is in an incredibly weak position, especially for an administration in its early stages. The debacle of Afghanistan has placed a premium on the Biden administration scoring some kind of foreign policy success. So this puts Iran in a very strong position. However, the Biden administration is in an invidious position when it comes to Iran because of the huge anti-Iranian bent of the American security establishment writ large and power of the Israel lobby, which is putting unceasing pressure on the Biden administration to play hardball with Iran. So this is a very interesting time. It's a huge stress test for the Biden administration. The recent establishment of this new military pact between the US, UK and Australia with China in mind is an act of weakness, not strength. And it's quite ludicrous that they're talking about taking on China just weeks after the humiliating debacle of Afghanistan. I think the Biden administration is in crisis already. It has multiplying domestic problems to contend with. The failure of the vaccine take-up, the failure of it, its ability to pass its program through Congress, despite it being Democratic Party-controlled Congress in its first term. I think the Biden administration is against the ropes. The Iranian government has cleverly understood this, understood it, now moved into a position of strength, and it's absolutely right that demands the lifting of sanctions as a precondition of talks. It's already made a huge compromise recently with the allowance of the IAEA to reset its monitoring equipment in Iran. But Iran now knows that it has a whip hand, and I think it's all a matter of time before the Biden administration will cave in to Iran's demand, despite the huge Washington establishment pressure for it to do otherwise.
Thank you very much for that. We are fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, John White, speaking there, writer and political analyst from Edinburgh. Thank you. Saeed Mustafa Khoshesh, many thanks, political analyst, who also spoke to us. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Tahweh, and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
In the limelight. Two weeks after the 2020 presidential election, a team of lawyers closely allied with Donald Trump held a widely watched news conference at the Republican Party headquarters in Washington. At the event, they laid out a bizarre conspiracy theory claiming that a voting machine company had worked with an election software firm, the financier George Soros, and the Venezuelan government to steal the presidential contest from Donald Trump. But there was a problem for the Trump team, according to court documents released on Monday evening, 20th of September. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times law and criminal justice correspondent, Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Trump Campaign New Lawyers' Voting Machine Claims Were Baseless, Memo Shows. Stay with us for more. Weeks after the 2020 presidential election, a team of lawyers closely allied with Donald Trump held a widely watched news conference at the Republican Party's headquarters in Washington. At the event, they laid out a bizarre conspiracy theory claiming that a voting machine company had worked with an election software firm, the financier George Soros, and the Venezuelan government to steal the presidential contest from Donald Trump. But there was a problem for the Trump team, according to court documents released on Monday evening, 20th of September. By the time the news conference occurred on 19th of November, Donald Trump's campaign had already prepared an internal memo on many of the outlandish claims about the company, Dominion Voting Systems, and a separate software company, Smartmatic. The memo had determined that those allegations were untrue. The court papers, which were initially filed late last week as a motion in a defamation lawsuit brought against the campaign and others by a former Dominion employee, Eric Coomer, contain evidence that officials in the Trump campaign were aware early on that many of the claims against the companies were baseless. The documents also suggest that the campaign sat on its findings about Dominion, even as Sidney Powell and other lawyers attacked the company in the conservative media and ultimately filed four federal lawsuits accusing it of a vast conspiracy to rig the election against Donald Trump. According to emails contained in the documents, Zach Parkinson, then the campaign's deputy director of communications, reached out to subordinates on 13th of November, asking them to substantiate or debunk several matters concerning Dominion. The next day, the emails show Zach Parkinson received a copy of a memo cobbled together by his staff from what largely appeared to be news articles and public fact-checking services. Even though the memo was hastily assembled, it rebutted a series of allegations that Sidney Powell and other lawyers were making in public. It found that Dominion Voting Systems did not use voting technology from the software company Smartmatic in the 2020 election. That Dominion Voting Systems had no direct ties to Venezuela or to George Soros. And that there was no evidence that Dominion's leadership had connections to left-wing Antifa activists, as Sidney Powell and other lawyers had claimed. As Mr. Coomer's lawyers wrote in their motion in the defamation lawsuit, the memo produced by the Trump campaign shows that, at least internally, the Trump campaign found there was no evidence to support the conspiracy theories regarding Dominion voting systems and Eric Coomer. Even at that time, many political observers and voters, Democratic and Republican alike, dismissed the efforts by Sidney Powell and other pro-Trump lawyers like Rudolph Giuliani as a wild last-ditch attempt to appease a defeated president in denial of his loss. But the false theories they spread quickly gained currency in the conservative media and endure nearly a year later. It is unclear if Donald Trump knew about or saw the memo. Still, the documents suggest that his campaign's communication staff remained silent about what it knew of the claims against Dominion at a moment when the allegations were circulating freely. The Trump campaign continued to allow its agents, the motion says, to advance debunked conspiracy theories and defame Eric Coomer, apparently without providing them with their own research debunking those theories. Mr. Coomer, Dominion's one-time director of product strategy and security, sued Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, and the Trump campaign, and others last year in state district court in Denver, Colorado. He has said that after the election, he was wrongly accused by a right-wing podcast host of hacking his company's systems to ensure Donald Trump's defeat, and of then telling left-wing activists that he had done so. Soon after the host, Joe Altman, made these accusations, they were seized upon and amplified by Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, who were part of a self-described elite strike force of lawyers leading the charge in challenging Joseph Biden Jr.'s victory. On 19th of November, for example, Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani appeared together at a news conference at the Republican National Committee headquarters and placed Mr. Coomer at the center of a plot to hijack the election by hacking Dominion's voting machines. By Ms. Powell's account that day, the conspiracy included Smartmatic, Venezuelan officials, people connected to George Soros, and a massive influence of communist money. Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani did not respond to messages seeking comment on the documents. Representatives of Donald Trump also did not respond to emails seeking comment. Donald Trump continues to falsely argue that the election was stolen from him, and in recent months, Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani have struck by their claims that the election was rife with fraud. A lawyer for Mr. Giuliani said in a court filing last month that at least some of his claims of election fraud were substantially true. And as recently as 3 weeks ago, Sidney Powell told a reporter for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the 2020 election was essentially a bloodless coup, where they took over the presidency of the United States without a single shot being fired. It remains unclear how widely the memo was circulated among Trump campaign staff members. According to the court documents, Rudy Giuliani said in a deposition that he had not seen the memo before he gave his presentation in Washington, and he questioned the motives of those who had prepared it. They wanted Trump to lose because they could raise more money, Mr. Giuliani was quoted as saying in the deposition. But at the time that the internal report was prepared, Mr. Giuliani and Ms. Powell were both active supervisors, as he put it, in his deposition, in the Trump campaign's broader plan to challenge the election results, an effort that eventually included more than 60 failed lawsuits filed across the country. While Sidney Powell soon went her own way in claiming that Dominion had conspired to steal the election, Rudy Giuliani continued working closely with Donald Trump and his campaign, ultimately changing strategies and seeking to persuade state legislatures to overturn the popular vote. The motion notes that the lines were blurred as to whom Sidney Powell was working for at the time, herself, her non-profit organization, or the Trump campaign. Almost immediately after she prompted the conspiracy theory about Dominion at a news conference in November, Donald Trump sought to distance himself from her. But by December, as Trump's legal options narrowed, the former president considered bringing her back into the fold and discussed whether to appoint her as a special counsel overseeing an investigation of voter fraud.